Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Friday, April 10th, and this is the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya, and alongside me as ever is Alex.
And good morning to you. Honestly, Maya, feels like we're operating in a system with so many interconnected pressures. It's like diagnosing a patient with multiple comorbidities. You pull on one thread and 10 others tight.
Always with the analogies, Alex. Right, let's get to it. First up, the fallout from the Iran conflict. Is the market already priced in the worst-case scenario, or are we bracing for another shock?
That's precisely where we're starting, and frankly, the initial reaction felt muted, which raises questions. Then we're diving into AI infrastructure. Everyone's building, but is there enough silicon to go around?
Good point. We'll also be unpacking the U.S. economy. Earnings season is in full swing, markets are volatile, and the Fed is always interesting.
And finally, we're looking beyond the usual suspects. Emerging markets are showing surprising resilience. Could they be the next strategic opportunity? I've uncovered some really compelling data on Southeast Asian tech.
Oh, really? I thought your focus was all on Latin American bonds this week.
Diversification is key, Maya. Diversification is key. Let's dig in.
Hungary's economic stagnation, coupled with systemic corruption, is the opening for Péter Magyar's campaign. It's a strange benchmark for macro analysis, but that's where we are. Let's unpack the fallout from the U.S.-Iran conflict. Specifically, the economic consequences, because frankly, that's what everyone cares about right now.
So here's the picture. The initial shockwave, as we've seen, wasn't a full-scale escalation, but the disruption to global shipping, particularly in the Strait of Hormuz, and the resulting energy price spikes. The IMF's downgrade of growth projections, even under optimistic scenarios, signals the seriousness of the situation, indicating a structural shift, not a temporary blip. We need to establish that baseline pre-war conditions are unlikely to return in the near term.
Unlikely feels generous. Kristina Georgieva isn't known for hyperbole. Lee Coppersmith mentioned investors de-risking through shorting in macro products, but also a surprisingly favorable positioning for a rally. That feels contradictory. What's going on there?
That contradiction reflects a market caught between fear and opportunity. The shorting was a response to the initial escalation threat, a defensive move. However, the two-week ceasefire triggered gains. The MSCI Asia-Pacific Index is demonstrating resilience as institutional investors repositioned, anticipating a de-escalation. It's a classic wall of worry scenario, but the level of caution is potentially excessive.
Excessive caution is usually a good idea when dealing with, say, a country that's threatening to collect tolls for passage through a vital shipping lane, potentially using Bitcoin. Pushkin framing it as speed running the hell out of de-dollarization is accurate.
Iran's willingness to accept cryptocurrency, even if it ultimately needs to convert to fiat, represents a significant acceleration of de-dollarization trends, bypassing intermediate steps. It's a direct response to sanctions and a strategic attempt to insulate itself from the U.S. financial system. The implication is broader. Other nations may follow suit, accelerating the shift away from dollar dominance.
Right. And China is perfectly positioned to facilitate that. Liangting too highlighted China's influence as the primary buyer of Iranian oil. It's not just about trade volume, is it?
No, it's about leverage. Iran needs China's economic support to generate revenue, giving China significant bargaining power in these negotiations. As Panikoff pointed out, the U.S. may not emerge ahead, with China and Russia standing to be the biggest winners. This isn't simply a bilateral conflict, it's a power struggle with global ramifications.
Panikoff also had a really interesting point about Russia and China vetoing the UN resolution regarding the Strait of Hormuz. It wasn't just about supporting Iran.
Something to flag here, the vetoes were about protecting their own geopolitical interests and choke points, specifically concerning freedom of navigation. They're setting a dangerous precedent beyond the Middle East, raising concerns about Taiwan and other strategic locations in East Asia. It's a systemic risk that the U.S. needs to address.
So the U.S. tried to knock Iran back to the Stone Age and ended up alienating the Iranian population and making internal regime change less likely. That's a strategic miscalculation if I've ever heard one.
A significant one. Panikoff emphasized that Iranians distinguish between the regime and their country's infrastructure. Harsh language fuels nationalistic sentiment, hindering the possibility of a regime change from within. The 1979 revolution required a shift in allegiance from those with weapons. This situation is drastically different.
It feels like a lot of the optimism we're seeing in the market is predicated on a very specific and fragile assumption that energy costs will stabilize.
That's precisely right. Ting Tu notes Jeffrey's analysis that the market's reaction is predicated on an expectation of an AI capex peak this year due to persistent high energy costs. Even if the war ends, the structural changes to energy costs will likely limit further AI investment. Current chip stock valuations may be unsustainable.
So the AI rally is at least partially a mirage built on an unrealistic energy price scenario.
A significant component of it, yes. High energy costs fundamentally impact the economics of AI infrastructure, data centers, cooling systems, manufacturing. A prolonged period of elevated prices will constrain investment, despite the current demand.
Let's talk specifics. What about the physical oil market? Rosenquist's comments about the scale of disruption, 10 to 15 million barrels per day being larger than OPEC or the Ukraine invasion, yet spot prices haven't fully captured that.
That's the key disconnect. Rosenquist points to the IEA's reported crude surplus of 2 to 3 million barrels per day as false, masking a balanced market. Stagnant global inventories, despite OPEC increasing production by 2 million barrels per day, suggest the market wasn't oversupplied. The physical dislocation isn't yet translating into larger price impacts due to existing, but incorrect, inventory assumptions.
And that disconnect is going to force a reassessment of oil market fundamentals.
We can trace that further. Rosenquist predicts that investors who have written off oil will return, revealing the fragility of the supply chain and driving investment into the sector, especially equities. It's a fundamental shift in perception, moving away from a long-term bearish outlook towards recognizing the potential for sustained price increases.
It seems like Ukraine's success with drones is having a ripple effect beyond its borders.
Very much so. The war in Iran is diverting U.S. attention and resources from Ukraine, negatively impacting Ukraine's negotiating position. But simultaneously, Ukraine's deployment of drones is redefining warfare dynamics, creating an asymmetric advantage and complicating the geopolitical landscape.
And Russia's role in all this? Adam Rosenquist mentioned lifting sanctions and increasing oil prices, effectively buying them time in Ukraine.
While it doesn't address the broader structural economic problems, the Iran-Russia dynamic is creating a budgetarily positive situation for Russia, allowing them to allocate 50-plus drones per target, exploiting parity to maximize attrition. It's a cynical but effective strategy, leveraging the conflict to prolong their engagement in Ukraine.
Okay, back to the markets. Big tech's opportunity, as Mike Washington discussed with Lee Coppersmith, is that just a temporary bounce, or is there something more substantial happening?
It's a nuanced situation. Coppersmith mentioned clients de-risking through shorting in macro products, but current positioning is now more favorable for a rally. The wall of worry is dissipating, but volatility has reset. Index geopolitical risk premiums are coming down.
But still a wall of worry. Sounds unconvincing.
The persistence of that worry is crucial. Despite the recent gains, investors risk missing upside if they remain overly cautious. It's a risk-reward trade-off, but the potential for further upside exists if the ceasefire holds and negotiations progress.
What about earnings? Robert Armstrong's comment about analysts increasing company earnings estimates despite the ongoing conflict is wild.
It is.
This divergence from typical crisis responses suggests a lack of realistic war impact assessment. Armstrong notes it's happening across sectors, with analysts merrily upping their view of how much money these companies are going to make. It's a significant indicator of market complacency.
And that's contrasted with bond markets signaling a return to pre-war interest rate cut expectations is unlikely.
There's a signal here. Bond markets are signaling that a quick return to February 27th conditions is unrealistic. Pushkin explicitly states there isn't a way back, and Armstrong emphasizes the need for a measure of realism. Oil prices have structurally reset at least $20 higher, and inflationary pressures are baked into bond markets.
So the S&P 500 near pre-war levels is a head fake?
Largely, yes. The gains are considered unsustainable given the persistent risks. As Robert Armstrong observed, the U.S. economy, less sensitive to inflation than Europe, is projected to outperform, but that doesn't invalidate the underlying vulnerabilities.
Victoria Gardner-Coates talked about Iran accepting Bitcoin for Strait of Hormuz passage. This isn't just about money, is it?
No.
It represents a rapid acceleration of de-dollarization trends, bypassing intermediate steps like the Petroyuan. Pushkin frames it as speed running the hell out of the narrative, moving directly from established currency to cryptocurrency in a high-stakes geopolitical context.
And Bob Michel predicting the U.S. will be the big winner in financial markets this year, citing its net oil exporter status.
Consider this, the U.S. benefits from its energy independence and relative economic resilience. The current crisis is likely to disproportionately benefit the U.S. financial system.
Okay, so let's make a concrete prediction. Given everything we've discussed, and focusing on the market's reaction to the ceasefire and the underlying energy price dynamics, we bet that by June 2026, WTI crude oil will be trading above $105 per barrel.
I agree. Given the limited resumption of tanker traffic through the Strait of Hormuz and the structural shifts in energy costs, $105 feels like a conservative estimate. We can revisit that in 6 months and see if the market's optimism is justified.
Agreed. And speaking of structural shifts, that brings us nicely to our next topic, AI infrastructure and scalability challenges. The conflict in Iran, as we've just seen, is fundamentally altering the economic landscape, and that has major implications for the future of AI development. Okay, so Mythos just got a $100 million security testing budget with access limited to 12 partners. That feels disproportionate. Is this just hype, or are we actually looking at a fundamental shift in the risk calculation around AI deployment?
It's not hype. Anthropic's approach with Mythos signifies a qualitatively different threat landscape. The sheer scale of its capabilities demands extreme containment. We're talking about proactively anticipating autonomous attacks capable of systematically exploiting codebases. As Kyne Warwick observed, shifting security from reactive patching to preemptive defense. The limited release isn't about scarcity, it's about minimizing the attack surface.
So less patching holes and more building a fortress around a potentially hostile entity. That's concerning. And the implication is that existing agent frameworks might be obsolete before they're even fully developed.
Two things stand out. Boris Cherny's suggestion to build for the model 6 months from now underlines that obsolescence. Models like Mythos have the potential to reduce the need for intricate harnesses and continuous prompting, performing tasks autonomously for extended periods. We're seeing a shift away from complex orchestration and towards direct model application.
6 months. In AI years, that's a geological epoch. Reminds me of trying to get a decent Wi-Fi signal on a transatlantic flight. You spend a fortune on the upgrade, and then the entire system resets every 5 minutes. Is the reliability issue the biggest hurdle right now?
Memory and recall are essential for agent intelligence, but we haven't achieved standard Web 2 reliability, the 99.9% uptime in AI infrastructure. The industry needs to address these consistency issues. That's why the focus is shifting to optimizing search costs, finding the right data, as Kyne Warwick's internal tool demonstrates. The core intelligence is there, but access is the bottleneck.
So the problem isn't making the AI smarter, it's making it remember what it already knows. Speaking of knowing things, are we seeing a cost optimization wave? Because it feels like everyone's chasing the shiniest object, regardless of price.
There's a definite shift towards utilizing cheaper models for simpler tasks and frontier models only for complex operations like auditing. Austin Griffith's experience oscillating between Opus and cheaper alternatives exemplifies this dynamic. It's a cyclical pattern, specialized cost, general power, efficient harnesses. It's just accelerating now with each new model release.
Efficient harnesses, like a tiny overpaid bureaucrat keeping a god in check. But even with cheaper models, the total bill has to be astronomical. How is Web3 uniquely positioned here?
Web3 projects, while still vulnerable, often feature deployed systems with dedicated bug bounties and thorough audits, creating a structural asymmetry in resilience. Web2 software often lacks those rigorous security measures. It's a pre-baked layer of protection.
So a slightly paranoid but ultimately more cautious development methodology. What about the DevOps side of things? Everyone's been promising AI-powered automation for years.
It's becoming increasingly viable. AI agents are automating DevOps tasks, potentially shifting the role of developers towards ideation and away from implementation. Austin Griffith explicitly describes stopping using AI for DevOps because it performs the tasks more effectively.
That's unsettling. So less coding, more telling the robot what to do. And is this where skill files come into play?
The pattern is clear. Skill files are emerging as crucial for drastically improving agent performance. They represent a new business opportunity and are accelerating knowledge acquisition. The iterative chewing glass approach, deploying, breaking, and coding, is a previously unarticulated workflow. Austin Griffith's description of finding dumb behavior and correcting it is telling.
Chewing glass. I'm filing that under peak AI development terminology. But the freely given nature of these skill files seems counterintuitive. Isn't that a competitive disadvantage?
It is counterintuitive. Mike Radar Relay observed that the files themselves are the core asset, often given away freely. This challenges traditional competitive strategies. It suggests a collaborative environment driven by collective improvement.
So open source intelligence for robots. What about local models? Are those just a pipe dream, or will they actually factor into this?
Local models are poised to act as triage systems for AI tasks, routing queries to frontier models based on complexity. Austin Griffith predicted this future, envisioning a local model handling initial assessment. They're currently hard-coded, but the potential is there.
Hard-coded triage sounds like a particularly inefficient bouncer. Okay, let's talk failures. Agents are supposed to be smarter than us. Are they actually?
Surprisingly, agents are prone to the same predictable failure modes as humans, laziness and pattern matching without verification. Rigorous simulation checks and iterative skill file refinement are essential. The example of simulating transactions but failing to account for NFT ownership illustrates this unexpected parallel.
So robots have procrastination issues. Wonderful. Are we finding ways to actually ensure quality in these skill files? It feels like a lot of faith in a potentially fallible system.
Interrogating the knowledge within skill files to eliminate redundancy, removing information already known by the LLM, is critical. Austin Griffith described this as a constant phase of feedback. Ensuring the files provide novel, valuable information is key.
Constant phase, like an endless search for non-overlapping circles. And what about the data itself? Is the sheer volume of synthetic data going to overwhelm the system?
The current development cycle has shifted from optimizing inference costs to optimizing search costs, efficiently retrieving relevant information. This signals a belief that the core intelligence is sufficient, but access is the bottleneck. ArcInvest's research on AI-generated texts surpassing human writing highlights the potential dominance of synthetic data.
We're training the robots with themselves. That feels like a philosophical minefield. Okay, one more practical question. How do you spot the real breakthroughs from the LARPy self-autonomous loops?
Distinguishing genuine breakthroughs requires deeper scrutiny due to the low barrier to entry for appearing legitimate. The ease of creating superficially credible AI projects creates a significant verification challenge.
LARPy, another new term for my lexicon. All right, big picture. If Anthropic and OpenAI are deploying these powerful AIs, what's the biggest quantifiable attack surface they're creating?
The deployment of powerful AI like Mythos creates a new, quantifiable attack surface for economic exploitation, likely leading to front-running or direct hacking of Ethereum. Austin Griffith predicts a Mythos market on Pala Market, anticipating insider trading and economic attacks.
A prediction market for AI hacks. That feels inevitable. So where do we stand? Sum it up for me. What's the central tension right now in this whole AI infrastructure scaling game?
The central, unresolved tension remains the gap between demonstrated AI capabilities and future possibilities. Models are already adept at scraping and performing complex tasks, but the semiconductor buildout is the key constraint. We're significantly underestimating the potential because of limited compute power. That's what keeps me up at night.
Compute power and the very real possibility that our robots are going to start writing better code than us. Which brings us neatly to the US economy and what happens when earnings reports are authored by a machine. The Fed is pretending to be a hawk while subtly signaling dovishness. It feels optimistic.
Optimistic is one way to put it. The market is pricing in about 50 basis points of cuts, and Reinhart pointed out the three phases since the pandemic: mistake, correction, normalization, suggests a leaning toward easing. But I think the truly interesting part is how the Fed's sensitivity to employment data versus inflation seems to be the driving force now.
Employment data is always the driving force. Numbers, people love numbers.
The data tells a story, and that's crucial in the context of consumer spending. Weaver highlighted the contrast between continued spending, net expectations at plus 18%, and sharply declining confidence, nearly half of consumers anticipating a worsening economy in the next 6 months. That's a really odd disconnect.
Odd is a charitable description.
It highlights a growing sense of caution, a shift toward essentials. Apparel down 16%, travel declining, those are early indicators. But it's the reversal of sentiment regarding prices, 57% citing rising prices now, that's significant. It suggests inflation isn't as transitory as some of the data might imply.
So 2022 PTSD, as MFS put it, isn't entirely unwarranted.
No, though they're also quick to point out the fixed income landscape is different now, higher starting yields, a weaker labor market. That's why they're maintaining a relatively unchanged risk positioning, despite the lack of premium compensation for risk. They're not seeing enough reward for taking on that exposure.
A $622 billion asset manager being cautious. That's a detail.
It ties directly into the broader geopolitical risk factor. MFS is concerned about shocks, like escalating inflationary metrics or energy supply disruptions, and that's playing out in the oil market right now. Elson, Murray, and Armstrong were noting Brent falling from $110 to $95 after the ceasefire announcement, but cautioned it's not fully normalized.
Which is where a sustained spike above $150, potentially $200 like we saw in 2008, becomes a problem.
Armstrong frames that as a regressive tax on consumers, disrupting the labor market. And that's where the Fed is really stuck, distinguishing temporary supply shocks from demand-driven inflation. It's a damned if you do scenario.
It's all just incredibly complicated clockwork, isn't it? Gears grinding, levers pulling, with the entire system balanced precariously on a single fragile spring.
That's a remarkably apt metaphor, actually. And it speaks to the need for nominal GDP targeting, as Reinhart recommends. Focusing on the overall economic impact, rather than getting bogged down in individual metrics.
So focus on the whole picture. What is the whole picture saying about earnings?
That's where things get really interesting. rising earnings estimates despite the multiple contraction we're seeing in equity markets. Mori specifically highlighted the resilience of the consumer, which is contradictory. Tech trading at its lowest multiples since 2022, but earnings are still going up.
Microsoft at a 20 times multiple. That's not terrible given its track record.
Armstrong called it black mold, enduring and consistent. He's hesitant to bet against it, even at that valuation. But the key, as Murray emphasized, is selective stock picking, identifying companies with strong pricing power.
Strong pricing power, meaning they can pass cost on to consumers without losing sales.
Worth noting that ties back into Weaver's consumer data, the shift towards essentials. Companies selling those goods are in a better position. European stocks, Murray also noted, potentially offer value because of that.
Small and mid-caps outperforming, driven by anticipation of lower rates. Russell 2000 up 5.5% year-to-date.
Stepping back, these indexes are reflecting a rotation out of large-cap tech towards companies more sensitive to interest rate changes. It's also indicative of an expectation that the Fed will ease policy.
Assuming inflation cooperates. But 57% of consumers already think it's not going to.
And the data supports that increasingly. L&G's analysis shows duration is not a consistent hedge against credit risk, only 58% success rate since 1989. That's a crucial point for fixed income investors.
58% success rate? That's barely better than a coin flip.
It's a telling detail. They're advocating for dynamic duration adjustment, aligning exposure with credit risk and prevailing market regimes. They've adopted a more defensive positioning given rising oil prices and geopolitical instability.
So cautious optimism tempered by a healthy dose of skepticism. What does all this mean for infrastructure?
It means funding is going to remain a challenge, even with the IIJA and IRA. The ASCE reports a $3.7 trillion gap. And the energy infrastructure needs have tripled between 2021 and 2025, a $600 billion gap alone. That's driven by increased electricity demand, fueled by data centers.
So even with generational investments, it's still uncertain.
The implication runs deeper, that uncertainty could significantly impact long-term capital investment. And as Mulvihill and Olson pointed out, private investment is critical, with Europe's models potentially offering valuable lessons.
I suppose if the political winds shift and that funding dries up, well, it's back to the fragile spring. I honestly don't know how this plays out, and I think that matters. The U.S. economy is too dependent on incredibly specific conditions, shale production capacity, nominal GDP growth, and a consumer who wants to spend despite everything to be easily predictable.
I agree completely, which underscores the urgency of looking beyond U.S.-centric data and considering emerging market resilience, because if our assumptions about domestic growth falter, we'll need to find opportunities elsewhere.
We were talking about the surprising strength of fixed income markets earlier, specifically how even geopolitical shocks aren't cratering everything as predicted. This feels connected to something bigger, doesn't it? Specifically, emerging markets.
We can trace that further. The recent two-week ceasefire certainly injected relief into EM fixed income. A 2-3% currency rally and a 22 basis point tightening of sovereign spreads proves that. But the real story isn't just a temporary reprieve from tail risk. It's the underlying fundamentals revealing surprising resilience.
Resilience feels like a strong word. Aren't we usually bracing for the other shoe to drop with EM economies?
Traditionally, yes. But look at currencies already trading below in February levels, dollar Brazil, dollar shekel, dollar CNY, that suggests a shift. Inska Kristevova pointed to decent real yields and low structural positioning as key factors. It's not about a complete absence of risk, but about a higher baseline level of stability than anticipated.
Okay, stability-ish. But Africa, for example, incredible demographic potential, right? 2.5 billion people by 2050, but also the IMF freezing bailout funds to Senegal due to hidden debt. How do you reconcile those two realities?
That highlights the absolutely critical need for a differentiated approach. South Africa's removal from the money laundering tracker is positive, but country-specific risks remain immense. The energy shock creates a really mixed environment. Angola and Nigeria benefit as net exporters, but countries like Zambia, Kenya, and Uganda are impacted as importers. It demands a case-by-case assessment.
So Africa isn't an investment strategy. It's a continent of wildly different strategies. Telecoms, then. Vodafone and Airtel showing strong revenue growth is interesting.
Their growth isn't simply a function of market opportunity, but a demographic shift. Almost half of global mobile money subscribers are now in sub-Saharan Africa, driven by this expanding working-age population. That's not just a revenue story, it's a fundamental change in the financial landscape.
40% of mobile money subscribers, that's genuinely wild. I mean, we're talking about skipping traditional banking infrastructure entirely.
The pattern is clear that structural change has implications beyond telecoms. Consider Argentina, historically vulnerable but now a net exporter of hydrocarbons. If inflationary pressures ease, it could become attractive. Conventional wisdom is being challenged by shifting economic realities.
Shifting realities and charitable giving. I'm looking at Promote Giving, the pledge for GPs to allocate up to 5% of their fund promote to charity. What's the connection here?
Joel Halsinger's concept of compounding purpose is key. He's building permanent funding models for philanthropy through successful investments, directing profits outwards. Ares has committed over $50 million through Pathfinder funds, demonstrating that maximizing returns isn't incompatible with positive impact. In fact, the integration of giving encourages a different, more robust investment approach.
The idea is higher returns enable more giving, creating a positive feedback loop. Frankly, it sounds a little utopian.
It's about aligning business incentives with charitable goals. Halsinger explicitly predicts permanent funding models, and his initial grant successes provide evidence. We're seeing a shift from isolated impact investments to building philanthropy into the core business model.
Okay, utopian, but maybe not completely ridiculous. Looking ahead, though, the real test for these emerging markets will be navigating continued de-dollarization trends. If we see a significant shift away from USD dominance, the calculus changes dramatically. Specifically, I'm watching Turkey's currency stability post-election. Will it hold? So, wrapping things up, it feels like we've been diagnosing a very complex patient today, not with a single illness, but a constellation of comorbidities impacting everything from energy flows to chip availability. The Iran conflict is obviously immediate, a potential 10 to 15 million barrel per day disruption, but it's acting as a pressure test on systems already strained by broader geopolitical realignments, particularly the China-US dynamic. And China's role as the primary buyer of Iranian oil, that's not a coincidence.
Two things stand out, and it highlights the underlying force at play, a systemic reshaping of baseline economic conditions. We spoke about energy costs stabilizing, but I think that's an unlikely assumption. We're witnessing a structural shift, not a temporary blip. The speed running of de-dollarization, while still nascent, is a symptom of this larger trend, nations seeking alternatives to traditional financial architecture. This ripples through everything, including emerging market resilience. We're seeing pockets of strength like Southeast Asian tech and a surprising stability in certain currencies, but it's a highly differentiated picture.
And that resilience feels conditional. We saw Hungary stagnating, the IMF downgrading growth projections. It's not a uniform story. But then you overlay that with AI, a force multiplier for all of these trends. We're speed running the development of incredibly powerful models, but we're chewing glass in terms of infrastructure, running into compute power bottlenecks. Which brings us back to energy, right? And now potentially a new market for trading the economic exploitation of AI, unfolding even within Ethereum.
It's clockwork, gears grinding, levers pulling. The key tension, as I see it, is between the impressive capabilities of these AI models and the absolute necessity for reliable infrastructure to deploy them safely and ethically. And the earnings volatility, that black mold we discussed, suggests a disconnect between market optimism and the underlying realities. Shorting in macro products isn't just pessimism, it's acknowledging a fragility we're not fully pricing in. The $622 billion asset manager caution is telling.
So where does that leave us? I'm particularly struck by the apparent disconnect between the S&P 500 rally and all the risks we've identified. Is this a wall of worry climb, or are we building on sand?
A compelling question. This feels like a moment analogous to the early stages of industrialization, where massive investment chases transformative technologies. The IIJA and IRA investments haven't yet fully translated into tangible returns. I suspect we'll see a new market emerge for anticipating and actively trading on the economic consequences of AI systems, and WTI crude above $105 by June 2026. But the Turkish currency post-election will be a crucial test of whether this emerging market resilience is more than just a mirage.
And beyond that, the role of synthetic data, the potential to reinforce biases, to lose control of the datasets, that's a genuinely unsettling question. It's a fragile spring.
Indeed. It's a damned if you do scenario. We're pushing forward, but we need to be acutely aware of the unintended consequences.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow, continuing to unpack these complexities.